Now I'd like to read with you this afternoon from the first book of Samuel. The first book of Samuel, and we're reading in chapter 1. First Samuel in chapter 1. And verse number 1. There was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephrathite. And he had two wives, the name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. And this man went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. And when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons, and her daughter's portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. And her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept, and did not eat. Then said Elkanah her husband to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not, and why is thy heart grieved? Am not I better to thee than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul, and prayed unto the Lord, and wept sore. And she vowed a vow, and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid, and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. And it came to pass, as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, how long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way, and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. And they rose up in the morning early, and worshipped before the Lord, and returned, and came to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come, about after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, because I have asked him of the Lord. The man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him, that he may appear before the Lord, and there abide forever. And Elkanah her husband said unto her, do what seemeth thee good, tarry until thou have weaned him. Only the Lord establish his word. So the woman abode and gave her son suck until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with 3 bullocks and 1 ephah of flour and a bottle of wine, and brought him unto the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And the child was young. And they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as the Lord liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I ask of him. Therefore also I have lent unto the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to the Lord, and he worshipped the Lord there. Now we look to the Lord for a blessing on our meditation together this afternoon. I have been drawn recently to just have a little look again at the birth and the early years of this great man called Samuel the prophet. And I would just like for your encouragement to share one or two things with you this afternoon that will appeal, I trust, to all, but maybe in particular, if I may so say, that may appeal to sisters in particular. We often say we are speaking to elders, and sometimes we say we're speaking to the young people. Well, I'm really speaking to everybody, but I think there's a little message here maybe for the sisters. But first of all, I just think it's necessary for us just to look at the background giving rise to the incoming of Samuel. Our brother Gary this morning was suggesting that there was maybe a relevant comparison between the times of these prophets of the exile and the days in which we live today. And if that is so, I can also see a relevance in the comparison between the days of Samuel and the days in which we live today. For so far as the time is concerned, we are in the time of the judges here. And spiritual conditions in Israel were at a very low ebb. It has often been quoted, I suppose, from the judges that one of the things that marked the times of the judges was that there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. We read that there was no magistrate in the land to restrain evil. And I think if we just look at these words, we can see immediately a comparison between that day and this day. We're living in days of self-assertion. We're living in days when men and women recoil from the idea of being under authority. And see, everybody seems just to have their own ways and their own will, and they will just do what suits them. And it seems to me that that characterized the times of the judges. The other thing that we notice is, I think we would have to go to chapter 3 for that, but we read there in chapter 3 that the word of the Lord was precious, rare in those days. There was no open vision. It almost seems that so dark were the days that the Lord had withdrawn himself from revealing himself and his word to his people. I'm also conscious of the fact, of course, that this is the first day of a new year. And I suppose it is relevant to say that in the beginning of the book of Samuel, God is phasing out something that is now obsolete, and he's about to bring in something that is new. For Samuel is the link between the times of the judges and the times of the monarchy from chapter 9 onwards. And we would see this afternoon, I'm still speaking by way of introduction, we would see this afternoon that although the days are dark, the days are not hopeless. They may have been depressing from man's standpoint, but you know, God is sovereign. In this book, for the first time, he is referred to as the Lord of hosts. And he is able to undertake where men fail. And he is able to raise up men in circumstances that are maybe unexpected in order that the testimony may be carried on. And that is really one of the things that is very much upon my mind today. So we're looking first of all at this man, Elkanah, and his two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. You will notice that Hannah is mentioned first. And it may very well be that Hannah was Elkanah's first wife. And because she was unable to bear children, Elkanah then married Peninnah, who did have children. I just have to say this, that usually in the Old Testament, where there is a domestic arrangement involving two wives, the recipe is normally one for friction and unhappiness in the home. It was so with Sarah and Hagar. It was so maybe to a lesser extent, but nonetheless it was so in the case of Leah and Rachel. And it is patently obvious that it was so here. Although it seems that dual wives were tolerated at this particular point in the history of Israel, we are just reminded of the words of the Lord Jesus in Matthew chapter 19, that in the beginning, it was not so. And it would perhaps have been better for Elkanah to have waited upon God rather than to take things into his own hands and marry this woman, Peninnah. He is described as an Ephrathite. And the idea behind the word Ephrath is that of fruitfulness. And yet here, in 1 Samuel, we have a man from Ephrath with a wife who is barren. Interestingly enough, he is also a man with priestly connections, because he came from the family of Korah. In 1 Chronicles chapter 6, would confirm that. And so, he had connections with the priestly line. And he lived in this place called Ramathaim Zophim. I'm just interested in that because both words seem to have the idea of high ground. You know, Ramathaim, it means the heights. Zophim means a watch point. And this man in his day, he seemed to have been a good man as far as conditions were concerned. And he lived in this place called Ramathaim Zophim. There is really something, isn't there, good, spiritually speaking, about living on the higher ground. Living in the hill country. We were just talking this morning at the breakfast table about the Mount of Transfiguration and how the Lord led his disciples up into that high mountain. And we were just saying that he found them at the seaside and he led them up the mountainside. That's where they were taught. That's where they heard the Savior pray. And that's where they were assured in relation to the future kingdom and so on, if you look at the mountains in Matthew's Gospel. So there seems to be a sense that this man was a man who lived in the heights. And Ramah was to be Samuel's home. Ramah was where he was born, if you look at verse number 20, I think. And Ramah was where he lived, if you look at chapter 7. And Ramah was where he was buried, if you look at the beginning of chapter 25. So Samuel was connected with this place called Ramah. And he and his family, and this is one of the commendable things about Elkanah, he went up year by year to Shiloh to keep the feasts of the Lord, to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts. Now that is really the background, I think, as things so far as Elkanah is concerned. And we have this interesting comment concerning his wives, that Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. We read later on, verse number 5, that the Lord had shut up her womb. Just interesting to observe how the Spirit of God in turning the Scriptures has taken care to tell us that the hand of the Lord was in Hannah's barrenness. And I just have to make the point, as I suppose we all would appreciate from our experience, that very often we do not understand the ways of God with us. We do not understand why certain things that we regard as adverse may happen to us while others seemingly are prospering. But you know, had it not been for this condition, we might never have known the character of the woman that Hannah was. We might never have known of her spiritual caliber had it not been for this situation that arose at Shiloh. And you'll observe, I'm sure you have done, that in Hannah's childlessness, she was like many other great Hebrew women. For instance, you mentioned Sarah in Genesis 15. Sarah was barren. Genesis 25, Rebecca was barren. Genesis 29, Rachel was barren. Come to the book of Judges 13, Manoah's wife was barren. And when we come into the New Testament, Luke tells us that the mother of John Baptist was barren as well. Now, I don't think that is without significance. We are being taught something here that is not to satisfy curiosity, but to ask us why it should be that these cases are recorded for us. And it seems to me, dear child of God today, that all these women had to learn that when nature proved itself incapable, that was God's opportunity to prove to them that with Him, nothing is impossible. We are associated today with the God of the impossible, the God who is able to do exceeding abundantly, more than we can ask or think. And of course, that's exactly how He comes to Abraham in Genesis chapter 18. In these seemingly impossible circumstances, He says to Abraham that day, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" And nothing is too hard for the Lord. And it's very interesting, isn't it, that the three great lifelong Nazarites who are named in our New Testament were all born of women who by nature were childless. We think of Samson. We think of Samuel. And we think of John Baptist. Not only were they all born of women who by nature were childless, but they were all raised by God in critical days. And maybe we can see that in the ministry, all of them at the end were rejected by the people that they came to deliver. So that is the background not only to Elkanah, but that is the background to Hannah. Now, notice the opposition. Verse number 6, her adversary also provoked her sore for to make her fret. We would notice earlier in our Bibles that this is not the first time that the other wife has taken advantage of the situation. It was to make her fret. And if you look at verse number 7 and read it as I read it, it seems to me at any rate that this was not something just as a momentary passing event. This was an ongoing thing over a lengthy period. Year by year, verse number 7, she provoked her. Therefore she wept, and she would not eat. There is no question that Hannah was dearly loved by Elkanah, as indeed Rachel was by Jacob. But in these circumstances, Elkanah is powerless. And Peninnah is relentless. She provoked her year unto year to make her fret. Dear fellow believer, this afternoon there is a sense in which we may be looked at as going through periods of barrenness and dark in our assembly testimony. It's possible that Christians from a more liberal surrounding would punt us and say, well, you know, nothing happens there. After all, the charismatics are overflowing. They're making all the running today. And these things, sometimes they deflect us from carrying out the mind of God. That is no reason for abandoning divine principles. No reason for turning aside or deflecting from the revelation of divine truth. What Hannah did in these circumstances was to turn to the Lord and to pour out her heart to Him and to seek the answer to her great problem in the power that comes from the Lord of hosts. And so Hannah goes into the presence of God. And in the presence of God, and in verse number 9 or thereabouts, in the presence of God, she begins to pray. I'd just like to notice in passing that Hannah's distress and Peninnah's provocation always seems to be in connection with the house of God at Shiloh. See it in verse 3, verse 4, verse 7. This was the place where God had caused His name to dwell. This was the place of testimony at that particular time. This was the place where the sons of Israel had to gather 3 times in the year by divine appointment, and they were not to come before the Lord empty. And it does seem that Hannah is taunted and tormented particularly in relation to the testimony at Shiloh. So I'm going to suggest to you this afternoon that Hannah was not in this condition purely because of her maternal instincts. We know that this was a reproach on Hebrew women generally. And every Hebrew woman longed to bear children. But I think in 1 Samuel chapter 1, there is more at stake than the desire for motherhood. Also, this would be both natural and legitimate. So what was it that brings Hannah into the presence of God at this particular time? And in that state of mind, I'm going to suggest a number of things. Certainly, I believe that Hannah had seen the neglect of the house of God. We just have to read these early chapters, and we cannot fail to reach the conclusion that things at Shiloh are not as they once were. There has been a marked deterioration. She must have witnessed that. She had seen the failure of the aged Eli. Look at verse 9. Now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple door. If we had time to go over into chapter 4, that tragic chapter where the ark of God is taken by the Philistines, he's still sitting on that seat, and from that seat he falls backwards, and it's there that he dies. It is symptomatic, not just of an old man, but of a man who is letting things go from the spiritual point of view. She must have witnessed that. And then we read that the sons of Eli, verse number 3, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. She had witnessed the gross sin and the immorality of the sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. In chapter 2 we read that the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. And Eli seemed patently helpless to put matters right so far as his own family were concerned. He told them that they were wrong, very gently, coaxed them. But after all, Eli was not only a priest, Eli was a judge. And I believe God expected him to deal firmly, more firmly, even with his family than he did. So it's against that background that Hannah comes into the presence of God and she unburdens her heart. Elkanah couldn't help. What is more surprising, maybe God's representative, Eli, seemed unable to understand. So things had really deteriorated from the days of the Exodus. These priests were supposed to be men of discernment. Malachi tells us, we were reading from Malachi this morning, the priest's lips should keep knowledge. And they should seek the law at his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. And yet he seems to unable to enter into the circumstances and grief of this woman in her need. So it is now a matter between Hannah and the Lord. I'd just like us to notice, as we think of Hannah's prayer, I was almost going to say, as we listen to it, but of course her prayer was a silent prayer, her lips moved, but it was silent, but we can think of it. And I want you to notice that her prayer, first of all, was purposeful. She vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid, and give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto the Lord, etc., etc. When Hannah came into the presence of God, there was a burden on her heart. There was nothing vague. Her quest was for a man-child. And with that purpose in view, she prays to the God, the Lord of hosts, with whom nothing is impossible. Then secondly, you'll notice that her prayer was persistent. Verse number 12. She continued praying before the Lord. And if you go down to verse number 20, her prayer was productive. Look at that lovely touch at the end of verse 19. And the Lord remembered Hannah. And it came to pass she bare a son and called his name Samuel. I'm sure that Hannah would well understand what James wrote almost at the end of our Bibles, that the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. Now, I just want you to notice something else. It's simple. It's good to see so many young people here today. If you go back with me to verse 11, you'll notice that when Hannah goes into the presence of God, she recognizes that she is coming into the presence of God who is omniscient. God sees. God sees. That's why she says, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy handmaid. Is it lovely to think that when we come into the presence of God for any reason at all, he knows exactly where we are. He knows exactly what we feel. He knows all about our problems and our anxieties. He knows about our sorrows as well as our joys. And we have a God of compassion who is able to look on the affliction of his people. That's how he looked at them in Egypt, wasn't it? And it's still true, although out of context, what Hagar said, thou God seest me. You know, the pagans, they set up their idols and they looked at the idols. And they could see the idols, but the idols couldn't see them. They could speak to the idols, but the idols couldn't hear them. You see, they were dumb and deaf and dead. We have a God who is living and who is interested in all the circumstances to which his people flock. What a comfort to the people of God, especially in dark days. Look on the affliction of thine handmaid. And she recognized that she is in the presence of a God who hears, so her prayer is not in vain. She says, remember me and not forget thine handmaid. Why, that was worthwhile, wasn't it? When we come to verse 19, in verse 11 she says, remember me. And in verse 19 we read, and the Lord remembered. It is no vain thing to wait upon the Lord. And sometimes, you know, we run ahead and we do things impetuously, and it would have been better for us if we'd waited on him in the first place. He sees and he hears. And she comes into the presence of one, and her faith is such that she believes that she is in the presence of a God who is able. And so she says, give me a man child. A man child. I just like to pause there, of course, because that is the great quest of her son. The quest seems to be for a man. Hannah is looking for a man child. Remember chapter 13, when Saul was rejected, Samuel says, the Lord has sought him a man after his own heart. When Saul was depressed, they said, his servants, let our Lord seek out a man who is a cunning player of the heart. Remember Goliath in chapter 17, give me a man that we may fight. So Hannah, at the beginning of this book, is looking for a man child. Could I suggest this afternoon that this spiritual woman is longing for a man who will represent God in the midst of unfaithfulness? A man who will stand for God in days of breakdown. A man who will bring restoration and deliverance to the people of God. You read chapter 4 through to 7, and you'll just see the problems that beset the nation, and how this man was to be the deliverer. And says, Hannah, I'll give him to the Lord, and there shall no razor come upon his head. This, of course, is associated with a vow of the Nazarite in Numbers chapter 6. Nature teaches us, says Paul, that a man of long hair is a shame to him. But yet the Nazarite, he must not allow a razor to come upon his head. And we discover what happened to Samson in the neglecting the Nazarite vow. I suggest that here is a man. And Hannah is saying, if I have that man-child, he will be prepared to surrender all his manly rights and all his manly attributes in submission to the Lord in whose house he will serve. That was the burden of Hannah's prayer at that particular time. I don't know what you mothers think, but it seems to me it must have been a severe test of Hannah's faith to vow to hand her son over to such a corrupt and debased priesthood. She knew all about Eli, and she knew about his sons. But after all, you see, Hannah is not vowing to give her son to Eli. She's not even giving her son to the temple. She's giving her son to the Lord. And that is the great difference. And I believe that Hannah understood that the Lord who preserved Joseph in the house of Potiphar And the Lord who preserved Moses in the house of Pharaoh's daughter. And the Lord who later is going to preserve Daniel in Babylon will preserve the deliverer of Israel now, even under the influence of this priestly setup in Shiloh. And Hannah there, I believe, is content to leave the matter with the Lord. I just feel today that there is a word there for mothers and maybe for grandmothers as well. The greatest thing, I've said this many times in other connections, the greatest thing that you can ever do is to rear your children for God. Our brother this morning was speaking of the role of the woman and the ministry of the woman. And I believe that if we look at Hannah this afternoon, we see here one of the greatest things that a mother can ever do, that is to covet and to rear her children for God above all else. She gets some comfort from Eli. She's prepared to accept Eli at his word. He says, go in peace. And having left the matter with the Lord, she eats. Her countenance is no more sad, but she received the answer, as you notice, in verse number 20. And so the prayer of chapter 1 is transformed into the song of chapter 2. And if you want to discover really the full context of the answer to Hannah's prayer, you'll just have to read the following chapters after the conference time today. But let's look at one or two things in that connection. She called his name Samuel, verse 20, saying, because I have asked him of the Lord. Hannah never forgot. And Samuel would never forget that he was the outcome of a mother's prayer. I almost paused in the reading this afternoon just to make the point, and I thought, I mustn't stop now. But when we come to verse 27 and she's in the temple, she says, for this child, I pray. I wonder how many mothers there are today. How many here? And they can look at sons who are growing up and going on with God, and in the presence of God could say, for this child, I pray. She called his name Samuel, that is, asked or heard of God. And she brings him into the house of the Lord. I'm not going to speak of the offerings at the end of the chapter because I've got an eye on the clock. I would just like to make the point that there's another birth in chapter 4. And that is the birth of the child from the wife of Phinehas, the son of Eli. How different the picture was. The ark of God has been taken. The old priest has died. And when she brings forth her son, she called his name Ichabod, saying, the glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken. I've known a few boys by the name of Samuel. I rather like it. I haven't yet come across anyone with the name of Ichabod. The glory is departed from Israel. But that, the two stand in contrast, the one with the other. The second thing I'd like you to notice this afternoon is, we may be surprised that a mother who's never had a child, she says, if you will give me a man child, I'll lend him to the Lord for as long as he lives. You know, we often say, that God is no man's debtor.
And he isn't.
And Hannah is going to be amply compensated for her seemingly temporary sacrifice. Look at chapter 2 with me just for a moment. Verse 21, and the Lord visited Hannah, so that she conceived, and bare 3 sons, and 2 daughters, so that the birth of Samuel was not the only birth, 3 sons and 2 daughters followed, proving that God is no man's debtor, but there was one special in the family, and one in the house was more worthwhile than a house full of Peninnah's children. Look at chapter 2 with me just for a moment, if you will. Verse 11. And Elkanah went to Ramah to his house, and the child did minister unto the Lord. Verse number 18. But Samuel ministered before the Lord, being a child with a linen ephod. Verse number 21. And the child Samuel grew before the Lord. Verse number 26. And the child Samuel grew on and was in favor both with the Lord and also with men. When we come to chapter 3, we discover that Samuel was to be the vehicle through which the mind of the Lord was to be communicated. It may surprise us that such a somber message was given to such a young child. He may have been about 12 in chapter 3 or thereabouts. But you see, it begins by saying the child ministered unto the Lord before Eli. He didn't minister to Eli, he ministered to the Lord in the presence of Eli. And then in verse 21 of chapter 3, and the Lord appeared again in Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord. When we come to the end of chapter 3, we read that all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord. So the last of Israel's judges becomes the first of the prophets, as we are told in Acts chapter 13. The other thing I just mentioned, I'm still in connection with the compensation for Hannah's prayer. When we come to chapter 9, 4 times in that chapter, Samuel is called the man of God. For this child I pray, she says. And now he is recognized in chapter 9 as the man of God. The man who was to rid Israel from Philistine domination and bring about a spiritual revolution in Israel. And the last thing I wanted to say was just this. It's lovely to think that the woman of prayer produces a man of prayer. For Samuel himself not only became a great servant to the house of God and to the nation, but Samuel himself became one of Israel's great intercessors. So the psalmist in Psalm 99, he compares Samuel with Moses and Aaron. Moses and Aaron among his priests. And Samuel, upon them that call upon his name. Jeremiah 2, as he thinks of the rebellion and the waywardness of the nation, he says, though Moses and Samuel stood before me, yet my mind could not be changed towards this people. So we must not be discouraged because days are dark. Because God can see further ahead than we can. And God is better prepared than we are. And out of the most unlikely circumstances, and the most unpromising circumstances, God is able to raise men and women too for the continuance of his testimony. God grant today that we have an exercise to stand for God and to live for God and to desire God for the next generation to raise up men who will indeed be men and women of God. May the Lord bless our meditation. May he give us encouragement as we continue to serve him by his grace.